Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Roger Montgomery, founder and chief investment officer of Montgomery Investment Management. Roger is the author of the best-selling investment book, Valuable, and he's a regular guest on ABC's The Business and Money News on 2GB. Roger was also the very first guest interviewed on this show nearly 2 years ago. We'll discuss the dangers of jumping on the momentum bandwagon, no matter how attractive it looks, two possible paths forward for the Aussie housing market, and two outwardly similar stocks with vastly different outlooks. Normally, I use this opportunity to ask listeners to share the podcast with a friend or like and subscribe on iTunes, but this week I just wanted to say thanks to everyone who's been doing that. We've been getting some really great results lately, and we couldn't achieve this without you, the audience. So keep tuning in, and thanks for sharing our content around. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Roger, welcome to the show. It's good to have you back on. You're actually the first guest that I've been able to say that to.
It's nice to be with you again, Patrick.
Obviously, there's a lot that's changed in the nearly... It's coming up on 2 years since I first spoke to you, both for us and the podcast here, and I'm sure for you, not to mention in markets. But let's get back to basics. I'm sure a lot of our listeners wouldn't have heard the first podcast and may not be familiar with you. So let's just get to know you a little bit first. Why don't you tell me a bit about the first investment you ever purchased and how did it go for you?
The first investment I made, I was at university and it was a container load of goat carcasses with the skin on to export to Sarawak. It didn't go very well because the buyers reneged. So not much of an investment there. The first financial markets investment for me was some bank shares actually for my mother. And that was Westpac, I think they were Westpac shares. And it was below $3 a share. I think it was about $2.80 a share or something like that. And I remember calling my mum. I was a stockbroker at the time. I was an analyst at a stockbroking firm in Melbourne called F.W. Holst. And I remember we were in the recession that we had to have. And there was a rumor that Kerry Packer was going to make a takeover bid for Westpac. And he was on the board of Westpac. And I remember saying to my mum, you'll never be able to buy Westpac shares for under $3 ever again. So you should get some. So that was the first investment I made in financial markets, and that was on behalf of my mother.
I suspect you were probably right about Westpac from what the share prices have done since then.
Yeah,
but I've got to say, goat skins is definitely one of the more unusual answers I've ever received to that question.
It's probably a reflection of the entrepreneur in me back then when I was at university.
Yes, definitely. Well, look, I know you talk a lot about quality, and I know it's an important attribute for you in the companies that you invest in. But let's talk a little bit about what that means to you. So could you tell me what does quality actually mean to you?
So quality for many investment managers means a bunch of things. And if you're a pragmatic investor, then quality really is quality management, a quality industry position, quality growth prospects. There's a whole range of ways you can define quality. For us, though, it's quite specific, and that is we're looking for businesses that have the ability to generate very high rates of return on incremental capital. What does that mean? It means that if a company's got, let's say, $1 billion of equity and it generates $100 million of profit, so it's generating a 10% return on its capital, it then reinvests that 100 million, all of it. So in other words, its equity grows to 1.1 billion. What is the rate of return that it can get on that additional $100 million? And we're looking for businesses that in a sustained and preferably consistent way over a long period of time can sustain a high rate of return on that incremental capital or grow their return on that incremental capital. That's a sign of a quality business for us. And ideally, if they can do that without debt.
Yeah, debt's definitely a big trap for a lot of companies, particularly
Not at the moment, it's not, obviously, Patrick, because interest rates are so low. So
that's very true.
Money's almost free. So, debt's not a big problem right now.
Which it seems odd because historically speaking, Australian corporates are actually not very highly leveraged at the moment, are they? From what I understand, is that true?
Yeah, that is true. What's also happened that's interesting is that large cap Australian companies have increased their payout ratios, which, you know, if companies don't have a lot of debt, they're not planning on growing, they're not investing in things. And if they're paying out most of their earnings as a dividend, they're not retaining capital to reinvest. And consequently, you know, the payout ratio has risen from about 50% about 10 years ago to about 80% today, or a little bit more than 80% today. So it's interesting that, you know, share prices are going through the roof at the same time that a lot of large companies aren't growing as fast as they were growing before.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of talk about X growth, particularly at the larger end of the Australian market. Just for the sake of the audience, I'll just clarify that when we're talking about payout ratios there, we're talking about the percentage of a company's profits or cash flows that they pay out in dividends, or That's potentially right. in some cases also buybacks. But let's talk a bit about where the market is today.
Sure.
When we spoke a couple of years ago, even then there was a narrative, and it certainly seemed, from my perspective, to be fairly accurate, that the market was late cycle, that we were, you know, getting close to the end of the cycle. There were a lot of managers out there who were urging caution. Value stocks were underperforming, and there are a lot of kind of frothy, high-growth stocks that were being bid up to outrageous prices. Now, while the names of those stocks have changed somewhat, it's now no longer Blackmores, now it's Afterpay instead. But 2 years later, we're at essentially the same point. So given all this, why shouldn't investors abandon the value approach and start buying these momentum stocks that appear to be making so much money?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question because it's difficult to know when the cycle is going to turn. But having said that, we know that history shows that it always does. Money is at record low levels in terms of price. Interest rates are incredibly low and cheap. That has fueled asset price revaluations upwards. So 2 years ago, we thought the market was expensive. It's now more expensive. 2 years ago, value stocks were underperforming. They've underperformed by even more. It seems the best way to make money over the last 2 years has been to buy the things that make the least profit, or to buy the things that have gone up in the previous year. You know, the best strategy in Aussie equities has been momentum. You know, the best factor, the best performing factor in markets has been momentum. In other words, just buy things that have been going up and they continue to go up by even more. Of course, you know, a year ago, well, not a year ago, 9 months ago, October last year, between October and December, we saw the market fall about 10% or thereabouts, maybe just a little bit more. And in those growth stocks, some of those growth stocks like Afterpay, which you mentioned earlier, some of them fell by 40 or 50% in a space of 3 months. We thought that was what we were expecting, that kind of event and that kind of reassessment of risk. But of course, what happened on Christmas Eve is the Fed came out essentially and said, we're going to take a more cautious approach on raising rates. We're going to take into consideration markets. And so it was off to the races again. And we had a V-shaped bottom in early January and stocks took off. You know, the big question that you raise, I think, is do you care about profits and do you care about cash flow, or do you just care about discount rates? Because that's the tension. The tension is that when interest rates are very low, businesses that have their large parts of their earnings further out on the horizon, they have a disproportionately larger positive benefit, or they benefit more significantly from any decline in interest rates. And of course, the Fed is, you know, everyone's expectations have switched from rate hikes back in October last year. There was an 80% chance of the US raising rates. Now there's a 100% chance that they're going to cut rates. So that backflip in terms of rate expectations has been a huge boost arithmetically to the valuations of companies that don't produce profits today, but are hoping to produce profits in the future. So there's a disconnect, consequently, between asset prices and asset valuations, because the asset prices have gone up much more than the valuations.
Now, I know you're a student of financial history, And actually, before I get into the question, I just want to define a couple of things. So investment styles broadly, here I'm talking about value, growth, and momentum. Value, obviously buying things for cheaper than they're worth. Growth, buying stocks that are likely to grow faster than the economy, and momentum being buying stocks that have gone up recently. Mm. Now, there are technical definitions for each of those that I won't get into, but I'd be curious, have you found that there are particular, amongst those styles, are there particular ones that perform well typically during the late stages of a bull market? And conversely, what tends to happen once we do have a crash, and how do those styles perform well or perform well or badly in the event of a major market crash?
Well, momentum performs the best in the late stages, right? When people throw caution to the wind, they're less concerned about risk and they're more concerned about missing out. And that's what we're seeing at the moment. So the fear of missing out on the possibility of some of these high growth stocks, the fear of missing out on the gains is what's motivating people to buy them. I spoke to a manager a couple of weeks ago and I asked him why he owned a couple of stocks that he owned in his portfolio. And he said, look, by not owning them, we're shorting them. So we have to own them. And that to me doesn't sound like investing. That just sounds like, you know, just hitching your barrow, I guess, to the momentum train. The other part of your question was, how do these strategies perform after a crash? Well, it's probably worth remembering that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway underperformed by something like 46% in 1999 compared to the Dow Jones. You know, he was underperforming by almost 50%. And everyone thought he was washed up. Everyone said, you know, he's into old school stocks and, you know, industrial stocks. But, you know, it really is all about the internet stocks and this new, what do they call it? The new phenomena, I think it was. Or there was a word that they used. New paradigm, that's what it was. And the new paradigm is e-commerce. These companies don't generate any revenue, but look how many people are looking at their websites. That's got to be able to be converted to revenue down the track. Buffett ignored that, was punished for it. And then, of course, the wheels fell off that momentum train and that fad. And then he looked like a genius again, yet he didn't change anything that he did. So value comes back. It hasn't been fashionable for the last 3 years. Up till 2016, the value investing strategy outperformed growth and outperformed momentum. But since 2016, it's been an underperformer. It's really tested the patience of value investors and their clients, but I suspect, you know, it will come back and it will outperform again.
You were pretty vocal about some of the dangers in what looked to be cheap stocks in the mining and mining services sectors during the early stages of the, relatively recent mining downturn. I remember seeing you on radio and on your website and on TV commenting about mining services in particular.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. You're right. I said recently, then I had to correct myself.
Yeah, the iron ore price fell by, you know, more than 50%. It fell by 60 or 70%. And
yeah,
we could see that supply response coming from the majors. So it was easy at that time to avoid those companies. Our mistake has been not investing in them when they're at their lows. And the reason for that is I think that, you know, we'll do just fine investing in high quality companies that don't produce commodities, businesses that do have pricing power, businesses that are able to generate monopoly type profits without risking our clients' funds in commodity type businesses. So that it looks wrong at the moment, but in the long run, if you look back over time at the performance of the share price of BHP, for example, yes, it's done well over the last 3 years, but if you go back further, you find that actually commodity stocks haven't done as well as high quality industrial companies.
While we're discussing that, I'm curious, do you think it's possible for a mining company to have a sustainable competitive advantage?
Well, the most valuable competitive advantage, yes, it is. They can have, for example, there can be, a geographic advantage, which is impossible to replicate. So there are some sources of advantage, but they're cost advantages, they're not pricing advantages. The most valuable competitive advantage is the ability to raise prices without a detrimental impact on your unit sales volume. So REA, for example, can raise the price of its premier ads and everybody still wants to advertise their house if they're going to sell it on REA. They're not going to see a detrimental impact on unit sales volume from raising prices. On the other hand, BHP, if it raises its price of copper or iron ore above the global market price, its volume goes to zero. In fact, recently it's been discounting some of its product in order to sell it to China. So it's not the case that commodity prices have the same characteristics as high quality industrial businesses that enjoy the benefits of the network effect or a monopoly competitive position.
Let's talk a little bit closer to home. The monthly data for June from CoreLogic actually showed some positive returns in Sydney and Melbourne.
For property prices?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
Sorry, I did forget to specify that. So yeah, we saw a bit of a turnaround in Sydney and Melbourne property prices, though it's worth noting that the overall five-city average did actually remain negative for the month. Do you think that the recent developments that we've had politically in monetary policy and on the regulatory front with the changes from APRA, do you think that they're sufficient to stop the downturn, or is this just going to be a blip on the radar, and why or why not?
So let's take a step back. You might remember that we again were very, very vocal calling for a correction in property prices. We've now seen a substantial correction in property prices. Some individual developments of apartments, the prices are off 30, 40, 50%. I know of property developers that are setting up funds to buy entire blocks of apartments that are being discounted by another 30% off the already lower prices. And I met with one only 2 weeks ago who's setting up a fund to do that. So we've been right on that. I know there are a couple of people out there who are saying they were the only ones who got that right. We weren't the only ones who got that right. We could see a supply response. We could see debt issues. And it's not the case. And people should be aware, just because the population is growing, that doesn't mean property prices always go up. If you think about the colonization, since the colonization of Australia, when white man first landed on the shores of Australia, the population's been growing. And throughout history, the population of the world has been growing. But that doesn't prevent property prices from falling in various jurisdictions. So it's just a weight of money argument that's wrong. So where are we now? Well, I actually think APRA's removal of that circa 7%, which isn't quite 7%, it's a bit less than that, but the banks make it 7%, that sort of stressed mortgage test, the removal of that is helpful. The lowering of interest rates is obviously helpful. Both of those things serve to actually help liquidity. In other words, the access or availability of money to borrow to buy property, that's positive. So for those reasons, I think we're very close to the bottom in property prices. But the caveat is, to what extent those two things, lowering interest rates and APRA's improvement of accessibility to money or finance, to what extent will that stimulate activity in residential construction? Because residential construction, or construction itself, is the third largest employer in Australia. About 9.6% of the workforce is employed directly in construction. And about 37% of that is in resi construction, residential construction. So that's 3.5%. 3.5% of the Australian workforce is directly employed in residential construction. And what we know has happened is that the pipeline of work for example, house and land package developers, the pipeline is down about 50%. So approvals have fallen 40% approvals for all residential construction in Australia, down about 40%. You can't build something unless you get approval. So if approvals are down, we know that construction is going to be down. Conversations I've had with developers, house and land package developers, is that they're seeing a 50% drop in their pipeline between now and Christmas, unless that stimulatory action by APRA and the RBA actually works. So we've got a problem. The problem is that construction is slowing down. It's the third largest employer in the country. That's why the Reserve Bank of Australia is cutting rates. I can tell you anecdotally, last year builders couldn't get bricklayers. And if they could find a bricklayer, they were paying bricklayers $1.80 to $1.90 a brick laid. Today, bricklayers are everywhere and they're offering to lay bricks for $1.20. So there's been a huge drop in income for bricklayers, for those bricklayers that actually can get work, and there's a lot less work on for bricklayers. So then if you think about the negative feedback loop, those guys, those bricklayers and those tradies, the sparkies, the electricians, the chippies, they're going to have less income if they keep their jobs. And if they've got less income, they're going to be spending less at the shops. And the retail sector is the second largest employer in the country. And consequently, you've got the second and third largest employers in the country slowing down. Again, that's why the RBA needs to cut rates and cut aggressively, which is why we've seen them do that already and they'll continue to do so. Because that cliff of activity for construction, residential construction, is coming. It's well known and it's there. So in a long-winded answer to a relatively short question from you, Patrick, but whether or not property prices actually bottom is really dependent on the extent to which the stimulatory action by the Reserve Bank of Australia and APRA is converted into the purchase of buildings, houses, freestanding houses and apartments that need to be newly constructed.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see how that one plays out then.
Indeed. It doesn't look good at the moment because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at the moment whether mortgage interest rates are 3.5% or 2.5%. That's not going to make a lick of difference to whether or not people are going to borrow money. What will matter is the amount of money they can actually get from a bank, and that's still lower than it was a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah, I can only talk personally here. This isn't based on data, but based on my own experience, there's also, I think, an element of not wanting to over-leverage for a lot of consumers. Regardless of what the interest rates are, it's the idea of taking on a mortgage, you know, that's a very, very large six-figure sum. For most people who are in their prime, you know, property buying age, it's not something that a lot of us want to do. I'm just speaking personally there, but I don't particularly want to have a $600,000 or $700,000 or $800,000 mortgage. But if I want to live in Melbourne in a house, then that's, in fact, it's probably not enough to live in a house in Melbourne. So I wonder whether that's playing a role as well.
Yeah, what you're referring to is I like to call the economics of enough. So what's actually happened is people have borrowed enough. They've bought enough stuff and eventually growth slows. And that's where you get a deleveraging occurring in the economy where credit growth is slower than economic growth. And I think there's a risk that we're now in that deleveraging phase. And you've just given me an anecdote to support that. People have said, you know what, I've borrowed enough already. I don't want to borrow anymore. And the boom, that fear of missing out on property gains that occurred, you know, at the end of the boom a few years ago, people did borrow a lot of money and they're now suffering as a consequence of that. They need to pay that off and that simply takes time.
Yeah, it should be interesting to see how it ends up. But look, there's a couple of stocks that I wanted to discuss. It seems like a bit of an odd comparison at first, but two of the worst performing stocks in the ASX 100 over the past 12 months have been AMP and Challenger. Both are down by about 45 to 50%, or they were a week or two ago. I haven't had a look more recently than that. Obviously, they're both kind of mid to large cap financials. They've both got market caps either side of $5 billion. They've both got short interest of about 7% and yield fairly similarly too. So on the surface, these two companies look fairly similar. Could you maybe compare and contrast the two for me and look out?
Sure.
What's happened and what are the outlooks and what are the differences in the quality of their businesses?
Yeah. So what you mentioned, Patrick, are the, you know, some of the metrics, market capitalization, dividend yield and so on. But that's not really looking at the business. That's only looking at the share prices and comparing them to something. The businesses are completely different businesses. I think AMP will struggle to be the large business that it was in the past. And that's because there's such massive change going on in the financial planner space. There's a reputational issue for AMP, obviously, after the Royal Commission, and financial planners around Australia are being forced to go back to university if they've never been to university before. So in order to maintain their license or retain their license, if they haven't got a university degree, they've got to go and get one. Now, there are plenty of financial planners who've been with AMP for decades who never went to university and don't want to go to university now. So AMP is going to have a smaller distribution network as a consequence of these changes. That makes it more challenging for AMP to grow its business back to where it was before. Now, AMP is not a business that we've ever invested in because I've never thought it met our quality criteria, the ability to retain large amounts of its profit at very high rates of return. Challenger is a different business. Challenger is an incredibly high quality business, and its long-term growth prospects are very, very good by virtue of the fact that the superannuation pool in Australia is growing significantly, and the proportion of that superannuation pool that is migrating from accumulation phase to pension phase is growing even faster than the total superannuation pool. So you've got growth on growth there, which is great. And then you've got the possibility, David Murray's financial system inquiry actually suggested that a proportion of everyone's super should be in the sorts of products that Challenger sells, which are these annuity style products, these annuity income products, lifetime annuities and so forth. So there's the prospect that down the track, not only is there growth on growth by virtue of the fact that the superannuation pool is growing, the proportion of money moving from accumulation to pension phase is growing even faster, and there's a possibility that a proportion of everyone's superannuation will be mandated to be in income producing products. So the long-term prospects for Challenger are actually very good, and I would say far superior to the long-term prospects for AMP, or certainly for me, easier to see the growth in the future. The challenge for Challenger is that the market was expecting them to be able to generate 18% returns on their equity, and they're not able to do that, or they haven't been able to do that in this low interest environment. And on top of that, in the low return environment that we're seeing, the perception in the marketplace is that demand for annuity income style products is lower because nobody wants to lock in a lifetime of income at, you know, at a subpar rate. So they're the issues facing Challenger, which, by the way, if you listen carefully to what I've said, you would probably agree that Challenger's challenges are less permanent than AMP's challenges, or more temporary than AMP's.
So, simple question for you. Do you think Challenger represents good value and an attractive proposition at today's prices?
It's certainly a possibility. We had shares in Challenger and did very well out of them, sold a lot of those shares near the highs, but retained a position because we felt that the long-term prospects of the business were very, very good. And then, of course, it downgraded, and so we still held some shares as the share price slumped. Would I buy more shares today? The answer to that is not yet. I'd like to see just how low interest rates go before deciding that we've seen the worst of the prospects for the company and that its prospects can only get better from here.
Well, look, we've got some favourite questions that I like to do with every guest. That's actually the end of the main part of the interview.
Well, looking forward to the questions.
I don't think we had these favourite questions the first time you were on the show, so it'll be great to get your responses to them. First of all, could you share something with us that you've read recently, either a book, an article, or it could be a piece of research, anything like that, that really impressed you or blew you away?
I am rereading Snowball by Alice Schroeder. And what's really fascinating is the consistent, I guess, commentary around the fact that Buffett makes, apart from the fact he's got a photographic memory, he actually, I guess, spins the investment process on its head. So instead of building a complete discounted cash flow model to decide whether or not to invest in something, He decides whether he wants to invest in something before he does any numbers at all. And the numbers that he does are very, very simple. In fact, he doesn't think about prospects at all. He thinks about the historical evidence of a company's growth and decides whether or not that can continue.
I'll put a link up to that book in the wire for this podcast in case the audience wants to track it down and have a read of it.
It's essential reading for any investor.
I couldn't agree with you more. I have a copy sitting at home on my shelf, and you've possibly tempted me to go open it up again, actually.
Good.
If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
It would be, with every dollar that you accumulate, invest it immediately. And yeah, what's been extraordinary is the rate of asset appreciation, particularly in the last few years. I can remember, I'll share a story with you. Back in the early 70s, my mother was living in West Brunswick in Melbourne. It's now a fairly trendy area. It wasn't then. It was a pretty rough neighbourhood when I was a kid. And the doctor whose house she was cleaning offered her the opportunity to buy his house, a double-fronted bluestone terrace fronting the park at Parkville, for $60,000. Now, my mum was earning, I think she was earning $16 a week or $19 a week at the time, and she could not fathom how in her lifetime she could possibly pay off $60,000. The doctor offered to vendor finance it for her. He actually said, I will lend you the money to buy this property so that you can raise your family in a nice area. And she just couldn't see past how she'd ever pay it off, so she declined the offer. And that was, you know, that really is a valuable lesson. We look at property prices today, we look at bank share prices today, and we ask ourselves, how could they possibly go up from here? But if you think that in 20 or 30 or 35 years' time, the population of Australia may be double, it's easy to see how in inner city areas, property prices will be much, much higher than they are today, just as they already are in places like New York and London and elsewhere in the world.
Well, I've got one last question for you, but before I get you to answer it, I do like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer here. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that anybody goes out there and puts all of their money in a single stock and forgets about it. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Look, I'll give everyone a little bit more information than just one stock. It's out of ARB, Reece, CSL, or Cochlear. It's a tough one to choose, but I would probably go with CSL.
Well, that's it for today then. Roger, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure, Patrick.
It's been great to talk to you again and to get your latest thoughts.
Patrick, always a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to our next interview together.